Listen and follow the Left Wing Rugby Podcast with me, Will Slattery, and Luke Fitzgerald.
As far as I can see, I always want to get in the Irish team. And that should be every young player's dream and ambition in this country. And if you're playing in a place where you're not going to get the opportunities in the big games, that they're the ones that get you picked. They are the ones, the Champions Cup games are the ones that get you picked. You need to be playing in a team and starting in a team for those games. It's as simple as that if you want to play in the Irish team.
Every week on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Remember, you can stay up to date on the latest news with the Irish Independent WhatsApp channel.
On this week's Big Tech Show, how will the latest developments in artificial intelligence affect your life? Will you get new powerful personal assistants? Are you in danger of something terrible happening? We explain what's going on.
Just a couple of weeks ago, Anthropic, which is OpenAI competitor, their startup lab, actually founded by former OpenAI employees, they actually eclipsed GPT-4 only just a couple of weeks ago with their latest model, and the internet went crazy. This is just better than GPT-4 at everything. So OpenAI had to respond to that.
The Big Tech Show, available on all podcast platforms.
Good Sunday morning. The world is waking up to a new inflection point in the war in the Middle East.
This weekend saw a dangerous spike in tensions in the Middle East as Iran fired its first direct attack on Israel. The sky lit up with hundreds of missiles, mainly intercepted by the Israelis' air defences.
We're hearing quite a lot of activity now. You can obviously hear the sirens. We're also hearing the sound of explosions as well.
This retaliation followed Israel's April 1st strike on an Iranian consulate in Syria, resulting in the deaths of a senior figure from Iran's Islamic Revolutionary Guards and multiple other officers. With tensions mounting, both sides are threatening further attacks.
Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu tonight saying the defensive systems are deployed, saying we are prepared for any scenario, both in defence and attack. Netanyahu once again vowing, whoever hurts us, we hurt him.
As the death toll in Gaza nears 35,000, there's a growing concern about a broader conflict in the region. The role of the US and the West in calming this situation remains uncertain.
President Biden says he also urged Netanyahu not to retaliate, but, quote, take the win. You've hit the win.
I'm Fionnán Sheehan, and today on the Indo Daily, I'm joined by Declan Power, defence analyst, and Claire Herriot, TRT World correspondent, to explore what this escalation means for relations in the Middle East, the implications for Gaza, and how close are we to all-out war. Claire, you're working with Turkish radio and television, so you're based in the Middle East. And given events of the last 6 months, we've seen this dramatic escalation now over the weekend. Talk to me about your view on what happened at the weekend.
What's happened over the weekend is that Iran launched 300 to 350 drones, missiles, from its own territory and from its proxies in Iraq, Syria, Yemen, possibly also Lebanon as well, reports of Lebanon too, this huge barrage of rockets into Israeli territory. Now, most of them were shot down before they entered Israel. There was some damage caused and a child was very badly injured. We believe that child to be a 7-year-old girl. And in terms of the infrastructure damage, there was some damage to an airbase in southern Israel. And it's that airbase, it's thought that the F-35s that attacked the Iranian embassy in Damascus in Syria took off from there. So some analysts are saying this morning that, you know, this gives Iran the opportunity to say, we hit the airbase and they are considering it, you know, honours even, and that they consider this matter, this operation, closed. So this was an unprecedented in the sense that Iran hadn't attacked Israel from its own territory before Saturday night, early hours of Sunday morning. And they're saying that was in retaliation to an attack that Israel is thought to have carried out on the Iranian embassy complex in Damascus in Syria.
And tell us about the extent of that attack from Israel. Unconfirmed on the Israelis' part in terms of responsibility, but all the fingers point in that direction. What played out there?
There's very little doubt that carried out from Israel was on April the 1st, in which the Iranian embassy in Damascus was flattened, essentially, and a number of people, around 13 people, we think, were killed, including senior members of Iran's elite Republican Guards.
Iran's Revolutionary Guard said one of their senior commanders was among the dead. Israel's military didn't comment, but it's thought to regularly strike Iran-linked targets.
And so the reason that Israel's thought to have attacked that is because the Iranian proxies, the Hezbollah group based in Lebanon, and other proxies were filtered through that embassy, and Hezbollah members were also thought to have been among the dead.
So at the moment, how volatile is the situation, and how great are the fears of a further escalation at this point?
This is incredibly volatile, and the fear is that this is the prelude to something bigger. There have been so many, you know, over the last few months, of these tense moments, these what-if moments in the conflict, Israel's war on Gaza and the related conflicts. If we take, for example, the border between Israel and Lebanon, one of the most dangerous places on earth, there is a low-grade war of attrition going on between the Hezbollah group and the Israeli military, which exchanges fire over that border. And you have thousands of people displaced on either side of the border, particularly in Lebanon, and people are dying across that border. So what's happened at the weekend is another one of these very tense moments. And I think the fear from a lot of people is that how Israel chooses to respond to this will dictate whether or not it becomes a massive flashpoint in the Middle East and an all-out war between Iran and Israel. So that this is a very scary moment indeed.
Declan, can I come to you? How long has the proxy war between Iran and Israel been going on for now, and in what format?
Well, it depends on whose point of view you want to take on that. I would argue it's been in existence for at least 20 years in one shape or form or another. And it's predicated by a desire by the Iranians in particular for dominance of the region. They want to see themselves as the regional power broker. And obviously Israel sees it in its own strategic interest to stymie that. And it's not just in Israel's interest, it's in everyone's interest, to be quite honest. I was going to say the West's interest. But Iran doesn't have the best interests of other players in the region. And indeed, they know it. And that's why the Gulf states have been making common cause with Israel, quietly, under the table somewhat, but in terms of intelligence sharing and security cooperation, that has been ongoing for at least a decade, probably more. The Gulf states see Iran as a long-term traditional enemy. The conflict in the Middle East, we keep thinking of it oftentimes in terms of the Israel-Palestine running sore. But the conflict goes deeper than that. It's Sunni-Shia.
Sunnis and Shia both practice Islam. But what's the difference? A disagreement 1,400 years ago over one simple question. Who would lead the Muslim community following the death of the Prophet Muhammad in 632 AD?
And you can find the Sunni-Shia fault lines oftentimes in different aspects of the conflict. And the Gulf states are Sunni. Iran is considered the heartland of Shia, the spiritual leader of Shia Islam. And Iran wants to dominate its area. It wants to be the regional player. And that is driving what it's doing now. So we must look at the backdrop to understand. They weren't really expecting, I think anyway, to lay serious gloves on Israel. They know their intelligence is good, and it doesn't have to be that good. Any cursory glance at Israel will tell you they've got very good air defense systems, both short range and long range. But by attacking the way they did, it was a conventional kinetic attack which gave Iran status internationally as a state. It was an act of war in retaliation, as far as they were concerned, for the attack on their embassy. The ball is now very much in Israel's court, and just because they have the kinetic power to do serious damage back to Iran and win a protracted war, a kinetic war, Israel is in very dangerous territory at the moment. The current government they have seem to be incapable of thinking along the sophisticated strategic lines that I have outlined earlier. And if they misstep here, they could seriously isolate themselves from the pivotal and utterly required Western support that they need and for their long-term security and longevity.
So how far or how close are we to that doomsday scenario of an all-out war between Israel and Iran?
That very much depends on what Israel does next. If Israel gives in to the behest of some of the, quite frankly, erratic and idiotic forces in the cabinet, such as the security minister, who says Israel should now go berserk.
Israel's response mustn't be wimpish, he says. The concept of containment and proportionality, these concepts became obsolete on October the 7th. In order to establish deterrence in the Middle East, you must show them that you've gone berserk and completely lost it.
But if it was to do something like that and do launch a catastrophic attack or a major attack with loss of life on Iranian targets, it would seriously escalate things in the sense that we can't fully understand. It's not purely Iran then that you may be looking at in a response. And Iran has been making common cause with Russia. Russia, we shouldn't forget, just because the spotlight of opprobrium is off them at the moment.
Your point, though, is Iran knew what would happen once these drones and missiles were fired at Israel, that Israel would have the capacity to shoot the vast majority of them down. So it was more spectacle that was at play here rather than a strategic attack that was designed to cause damage and death.
Well, I think it was a bit of both, Fionnán, in fairness. I think they were probably hoping for greater damage. There was a spectrum of air technology used, you know, from some very basic drone technology to cruise missiles. And I think they probably thought the cruise missiles would do more damage. But I think even notwithstanding their desire for a bit more damage, there was a degree of a controlled response there, I would argue. It was about spectacle. It was about showing a multifaceted attack from a number of multinational platforms. So there was a degree of strength and coordination and showing that it wasn't just Iran either. Like the Houthis were involved, Hezbollah and Lebanon were involved. And what does Israel do? This is what it comes back to. And this is where I think there may have been some serious strategic thought on the Iranian side from either themselves or whoever else was assisting them. If Israel decides to go all out and be methodical and attack all the sites, that's a number of sites, including Hezbollah. Missiles don't always go exactly where they're supposed to go. What if a few stray missiles hit the UNIFIL troops in Lebanon? And those troops, they don't just include ours, the Irish. They include a number of other leading EU countries. What's the response going to be then? The damage Israel could do to itself goes beyond just the reputational damage that they already have done.
Claire, the issue now is that, I suppose, relations were already strained between Israel and their traditional allies who were trying to get bring about a ceasefire in Gaza. This attack by Iran has certainly captured international attention. Where do you see the United States lining up here?
The way that the United States is framing this is that this was a deliberate attack from Iran to cause damage and not something that was, you know, for show. So they are saying, you know, take the wind and defuse the situation.
The president reaffirmed his commitment to Israel's security while making clear the U.S. will not participate in its response to Iran. Israeli officials now renewing vows to retaliate without elaborating on exactly how.
The other allies that came to Israel's defense, so the UK and France, are saying similar comments as well.
We're urging our Israeli friends to be smart as well as tough, to use head as well as heart, not to strike back, but to recognize that actually Iran has suffered a tactical and strategic defeat, and Israel should now focus on Hamas and making sure they get that hostage deal and that we try to bring peace and stability to Gaza.
I think what's interesting here is that, you know, Israel was it was increasingly isolated on the world stage over the war on Gaza. And, you know, France, for example, had been very critical in the early days. President Macron, I think he was the first G7 leader to criticise in very strong terms what Israel was doing in Gaza in October.
These babies, these ladies, these old people are bombed and killed. There is no reason for that and no legitimacy. So we do urge Israel to stop.
You also got, you know, the ICJ saying that there's a plausible case for genocide.
Their ruling concluded that South Africa's claims were plausible and that Israel, by the dehumanizing language of its leaders, had shown intent. She directly quoted Israel's president and its defense minister.
Minister Gallant stated, "I have released all restraints. You saw what we are fighting against. We are fighting human animals. This is the ISIS of Gaza."
When I woke up on Sunday and was looking at commentators from this region, from the Middle East region, there was a lot of criticism of Iran because they were saying Israel was looking more isolated. It was almost looking like a pariah. And now, because of this attack, it's ended up making the allies of Israel's allies more coherent and making Israel look more like a victim in this because of the extent of the Iranian onslaught at the weekend. So, you know, all eyes are on Israel and what the government does. And, you know, I agree with what Declan was saying about the some of the characters in the Israeli government. And the thing that I would add is that there are essentially two governments in Israel. There's the regular cabinet and the war cabinet. It is not a coherent entity. They don't have a coherent policy towards the occupied West Bank either. And the Prime Minister is under intense domestic pressure as well.
What impact do you see this now having on the situation in Gaza? Is it, as you say, likely to bring back support towards Israel, or will Israel see an opportunity now to perhaps be seen to ease off on that level now that it has got international support back on its side?
I think that the criticism of Israel's conduct in Gaza is not going to go away. You know, I mentioned the ICJ before. There's also the UN Special Rapporteur, Francesca Albanese. She's laid out in very strong terms that this is a genocide. And ultimately, the court will decide that. But there's a lot of, you know, evidence now pointing towards that. I think one of the things about what's happened at the weekend is that it's allowed for some distraction from what's happening in Gaza, where there is a famine and where women and children are paying the disproportionate price for the October 7th attacks. And that is not going away. Obviously, we touched on Ukraine earlier as well. That's something that's also getting less attention and being overlooked. And another point in the Middle East, another place in the Middle East that's being overlooked is Jordan. And, you know, the stability in the region depends on having a stable Jordan. Jordan was involved as well on the weekend in the downing of the missiles and drones coming from Iran to Israel. That's not a good look domestically in Jordan, to be seen to be defending Israel. Now, what the Jordanian government says is they were defending themselves, but the Jordanian government's under a lot of pressure. So there's a lot of things going on in the background that are still happening. And there's one, you know, a school of thought that this is part of a distraction of these other very important issues.
Declan, can I be a little bit parochial for a moment and look at Irish interests here? We're one of the countries looking to recognise Palestinian statehood. How are these events impacting on a campaign like that?
Well, I think it probably ratchets up the pressure a little bit. Like, the Irish government has been consistent in its support for that concept. And I think, if the truth be told, I think it's still very much at the conceptual stage. I know there's a lot has been written about the Spanish would like to see this happen by July. Maybe that'll happen. But I have a sneaking suspicion that it won't happen as quickly as that, because it really boils down to one key thing. Which Palestinians are you really going to be supporting? You can get into the semantics and say there's only one Palestinian government authority, president, etc., or that you want to support, as Micheál Martin said, the Palestinian people and give them support for the notion of a homeland and state. And I think most of us would agree with that. But the big elephant in the room here is Hamas. You know, as long as they're still in the driving seat, any right-thinking state or group of states want to lend their badge of legitimacy to an odious terrorist grouping. We could be virtue signalling. We could do something that would just make us look like hurlers on the ditch, to use an Irish phrase. Instead, what we're doing is trying to get this done through a consensus of at least a critical mass of EU states. And I think that is the way to go, building that. And I think the other states know that as well. So the more they get, the more potency it gives the Palestinian cause. And if that takes a little bit longer, so be it.
What about Irish peacekeepers who are basically in the crossfire now between the Israeli Defense Forces, Hezbollah, and now Iran? They're right there in the middle of this tinderbox.
Yeah, and not for the first time, Irish troops and their partners from other countries, in this case mostly European countries. It's actually what probably gives UNIFIL its bit of oomph at the moment, that it's got some key EU players in the contingent, including the Irish, who have a lot of time and experience there. We've been there before, caught in the middle and caught in some serious operational circumstances in Operation Accountability, Operation Grapes of Wrath, when the Israelis nearly bombarded southern Lebanon back to the Stone Age. However, this is a little bit trickier because Hezbollah has grown in strength and has been allowed grow in strength by the Lebanese government. They're part of it now, and by the international community. They seeped into the fabric of Lebanese society. And it wouldn't be any harm if some of our leadership at governmental level were to remind the Lebanese of their responsibilities in this case, and to remind the Irish public, who are very altruistically going out and marching on behalf of the Palestinian people, to remember that Hezbollah put a few Irishmen in their graves.
In Lebanon, a military court has charged five members of the Hezbollah militia with the killing of Irish peacekeeper Private Sean Rooney last year. If found guilty, the men could face the death penalty under the Lebanese penal code.
This Russian-Iran alliance, this potential for a global conflict, do you see it escalating to that level, Declan, or do you think this is just about further undermining and weakening Western solidarity?
Well, I think they go hand in hand, Fionnán, what you've just said there. I mean, I think it's about both. I think as I said, the Russians are delighted. This kind of opened another front that took the pressure off them about Ukraine. I think the Chinese are probably quietly the ones likely to benefit most in terms of the instability it creates. The Chinese always think so far ahead, and they're looking at how this might benefit them and their desires to pull Taiwan back under their rule or to extend their footprint of influence and potency in the region that they want to dominate. The reality of it is, the more battlefields you have, and I'm not just talking about kinetic battlefields, ideological battlefields you have, the more it creates a moral confusion. And I wouldn't say there's a lot of sympathy in a lot of circles for Israel, because the Israelis didn't have to take the route they took. There was a massive support for them after what happened on October the 7th with the Hamas atrocity. And they squandered that capital and they damaged others. As I said, the influence of trying to get Western focus to stay behind Ukraine has been dissipated significantly. So Israel needs to learn a lesson here. And that lesson is, when they're on the back foot and they're defending themselves, they get the support they need. When they go off reservation and they go on the offensive in a way that is unnecessary and it diminishes their own security, but diminishes the security of others in the region and beyond, then they start to lose that support.
And my thanks to Claire Herriot and to Declan Power. I'm Fionnán Sheehan, and today's episode of the Indo Daily was produced by Ian Doyle, researched by Shane Brennan, with sound by Gavin Hennessy. Archive clips from CNN, CBS, BBC News, Al Jazeera, ABC and the Irish Independent. If you enjoy the Indo Daily, don't forget to follow and leave us a review.
Remember, you can stay up to date on the latest news with the Irish Independent WhatsApp channel.